So welcome everybody, welcome to the Bonkers Brit, and this week my guest is Brandon Spars. Hi Brandon.
Hi, how are you Claire? Nice to be here.
Good, it's lovely to have you here. Now I'm going to go through and talk about Brandon Spars, who is such an interesting person. I love Brandon's stories. Brandon's been on 6 Feet Apart Sunday Night Stories. I first saw you, Brandon, when Dave and Juliet Picorni had the Wine Country Spoken Word Festival.
Oh, yeah.
And that's where I first saw you and I first saw Bill Lepp, and it was like, oh my God, you're both brilliant. So that's when I first saw you. That was like 2018, I think. And that's when I really first got into storytelling was then, and you were like, blew me away.
Well, you're very kind.
You've got this excellent quote from Bill Lepp, which I'm going to read, because you're both like two of my favourite storytellers. And so it's lovely that Bill Lepp has written about you. So this is Bill Lepp's quote. Well, first off, he's at least 8 feet tall, because you are tall, aren't you? You can't tell by looking at him if he's entertaining. Some people look like they have interesting stories to tell. Some look like they may work in finance. Brandon sort of leads towards the finance side. Or a high school teacher, which makes sense because he is a high school teacher, but that just adds to his mystique.
So funny. I think when he first saw me tell a story, I took the microphone and I was kind of hunched over, you know, and then as I get going, I loosen up and I kind of unfurl or whatever. And I think that's what he was writing about.
Well, you do. You've got such a presence on the stage. And when you tell a story, you like embody all of it. I just think you're the most expressive storyteller that I've come across.
Well, thank you.
So you are a teacher. You're a teacher of both high school humanities and college writing. You've always brought storytelling into your lessons. I would love to be one of your students because you do history and English language. I mean, I had some really boring teachers. In fact, my history teacher at school was so boring that I gave up history. So I know so little about history because she was as dull as dead.
I don't understand that, how... There are so many wonderful stories in history, and that's where my storytelling began, was in the classroom. Yeah. And not just, you know, the stories like Gilgamesh or, you know, historical chronicles of Ashoka or things like that we do in my class, but I started telling stories about when I visited these places that I'm talking about in the classroom. And I think the students really like to see how I connected with the material that I was bringing to the classroom through, again, stories. So it was the stories, the historical chronicles and things that I was telling to the classroom, but then it was also personal stories about my experience in some of those places, especially Indonesia, where I've spent a lot of time, or the Marshall Islands, or places like that.
So where are the Marshall Islands?
So they're in between Hawaii and Guam.
Oh, right.
You probably don't know because you can't see them on the globe. They're too small.
There will be
a word floating out in the middle of nowhere that says the Marshall Islands. It's 27 islands, but island is a misnomer. They're actually atolls. So it's like a coral reef that had grown around what once was an island, but then the island sank back into the ocean. So all there is this ring of reef above land. And some of them are like Majuro, where I was 27 miles long.
Wow.
But only 300 feet wide.
Oh.
And so you're living like on something that's like an airport runway, really. I mean.
And what was there on the island then? And what made you go there?
Well, there's 30,000 people living on Majuro, and there was a national college, yeah.
No.
And I was a teacher there for 2 years.
On a runway? 27-mile runway. That's bizarre.
Yeah. And that's how they get their rainwater, is there is a runway because planes land there and the rain washes off the runway into this catch system. And that's the city water that is pumped into your house. And so I'm sure there's jet fuel. And
I was going to say, water. That's probably not the most healthy of water, is it?
No.
And how did you end up there?
Oh gosh, let's see. I was a graduate student. And I did Indonesian studies, and needless to say, there aren't too many jobs for that. So I was looking for college writing jobs, and that was one that I found. They agreed to hire me right away. And so I went out there and did a 2-year contract, brought the whole family.
Wow.
So I have a couple stories from living in the Marshall Islands. And one of them is about the most impressive thing on the island wasn't the island itself. It was this man who is 7 feet tall. The Pacific Islanders are big, strong people. And he was extraordinarily big, even for a Pacific Islander. His name was Consuma. I don't know if that was a nickname given to him or what. And it's actually not a very good name for him because he doesn't go shopping. He was homeless, and he would go into the supermarket and just take everything he wanted. And he was so big and strong, no one could get it back from him, and he would just walk out with it. And very often, he had a large machete with him, too. And
no, you wouldn't attack that, then, would you? You would say, excuse me, you haven't paid for that, sir.
Right? And they don't allow guns, even for the police. So he had overpowered 4 officers at once before. So they just let him do whatever he wanted. And he would just take clothing off people's clotheslines. And so he'd be wearing a woman's muumuu that went down just to his thighs and marching around, you know, taking whatever he wanted. It was very alarming to be in the supermarket. And then over the loudspeaker, someone would say, Consuma is in the store, everyone to aisle 8. And aisle 8 was where the only place in the store that had nothing he wanted, it was the diaper aisle. So we would all huddle there and wait for him to leave, and he'd go marching around with huge frozen fish and boxes of cereal, and then he'd leave. Funny.
And they just let him do it, and just that's just one of the things, they're feeding the local homeless man.
Yes.
He's like giving back, community service.
Right.
Care in the community, let him do whatever he likes.
Yeah.
How
pretty
funny.
Much. So that we had lots of adventures there. And yeah, I like to tell stories about the Marshall Islands and about Consuma and his many adventures. A lot of my stories are, of course, about Indonesia, where I lived for 6 years of my life and I married an Indonesian woman.
I know, you've got lovely stories. You did tell a really lovely story about how you met your wife on 6 Feet Apart production, Sunday Night Stories, when you did your thing with Bill Lepp. So anybody who's interested in that, go and watch Sunday Night Stories from April with the Bill Lepp special, because it's a brilliant story.
And that was the only time I've told that story, actually. That was the first time formally telling it on a stage. So
that's a great story.
Fun to do.
No, it's lovely. It's so romantic. So I like to ask everybody a funny fact that not many people know about them. And your funny fact could be my funny fact. It's that you're a terrible singer. You're mortified when you have to do karaoke, but every morning before everyone's awake, you sing quietly to your poor dog, who must hopefully be deaf or not be able to hear you on that level or something.
And it's the German Shepherd, and so he does this head tilt as I'm
singing. I love the head tilt. Yeah, we had German Shepherds, yeah.
He's just so puzzled, and I think he just wonders, why am I singing to him?
Yes.
But a lot of the songs are just made up and they're about him. So.
Oh, how sweet. And so do you like singing then?
Just to him. No, I don't sing in the shower or any other time. It's just our one special way of interacting. There are people out there who sing to their dogs. I have the feeling that it's more common than we might think. I don't know. They're just such good audiences. It seems like a very natural thing to do when it's just you and the dog.
I know, they don't answer back and say that's terrible. I've got a story about my son when he was like 6 or 8 months old. I took him to a toddler group, and at the end we all sat round with your baby's on your lap and you sang nursery rhymes, and I always used to mime. And one day I sort of must have forgotten to mime, and actually, you know, sound came out of my mouth, and he turned around with a big pudgy paw and just put it over my mouth. Like, don't sing, mum, you're terrible. A little bugger, he wasn't even a year old.
What? That is so amazing.
So, I mean, I did. If I hadn't known already that I had a terrible voice, which obviously I did, then he confirmed it. And the only time I've ever done karaoke was in Cyprus when a friend of mine was getting married, and we all went out for like a bit of a hen night, got trashed. completely drunk, and then four of us girls thought it was a really sensible idea to sing Gloria Gaynor's I Will Survive.
Oh my gosh, that's
obviously I had the best voice in the room, you know.
When I first got to Indonesia, it was Sumatra, and I hadn't really lived outside of the country, let alone that far away. And every meeting I went to with this, I was a volunteer English teacher, and karaoke was kind of a new thing there. And they would wheel out this karaoke machine and they would make me sing in front of all these professors, you know, with their
shirts
and their glasses. And every time it was the same song, Feelings,
trying to sing.
Oh my gosh. And I would finish, there would be no applause, and they would scrutinize me. And very often they would just say, again, do it again. I guess they were focusing on my accent, or, you know, I don't know what was going on.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Oh, I had to sing Feelings so many times, and I'm traumatized when I hear it on the radio.
I'm not surprised. That's a horrible song to have to sing.
And I never sing that to my dog.
But I'm sure your dog's very happy about that.
Yeah,
anyway, that's a very funny fact, and I'm there with you, Brandon. So let's just start with your storytelling, because you've also written books, and we're going to come to the books in a minute. But you've not only been a TEDx speaker, you've been a 5-time champion of the Moth, and you've run 2 or 3 Grand Slams, haven't you?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, amazing. So did you just get into storytelling because of the teaching? Yeah. I mean, is that how it came about, from the teaching to the storytelling, or the storytelling to the teaching?
Yeah. Well, first I would say it was the teaching, definitely. And I developed a lot of stories, but they were very rough and loose and kind of choppy. But then I noticed there was a local storytelling group in Santa Rosa, the Do Tell Swap. And there's one in just about every city. It's pretty surprising. There's a local storytelling guild. And I started going to those meetings, and I began having to craft my stories so that they fit that 5-minute time limit that you
That's
know.
It's quite hard, isn't it?
It's very hard. And of course, it forces you to be a better storyteller, to really think about what parts advance the story and aren't just self-indulgent description and things like that that I would throw in the classroom. And so they approached me and they said they wanted me to tell at an event called Telebration. And I thought, whoa, I better practice, because that was up here at the Glazer Center. Audience was 350 people. I had never done anything like that. And this is about 8 years ago or something like that. And I thought I should practice. And so I signed up. Someone told me about the Moth, and I went and I threw my name in the hat. And of course, that was an audience of 570 down at Berkeley at the Freight and Salvage. I didn't know what I was getting into.
I had exactly the same experience.
And so I did a few of, I know you've done, and you were in the Grand Slam, right?
Well, I am now, but long story, but anyway, my first experience was Berkeley, and I put my name in that first person out of the hat, never even seen one before. So that was terrifying.
The first person is the roughest.
The worst as well, isn't it? So the worst position, and I'd never seen anyone do it before.
Yeah.
And so it's a big
You had no idea when you're going into it. I hadn't either. I think I was the seventh or something. So I got to see other people before me. Daya Lakshminarayanan was the host, and she was wonderful. And the whole evening was kind of magical. And I won that night. And then I was invited to the Grand Slam, and I've done 3 Grand Slams, actually. I won 2 of those.
Wow, and that's amazing. That's quite an achievement.
Well,
it's a stiff competition at the Moth, isn't there?
Yes, and it's just hard to even get on the stage now, because
40 people in the house.
Exactly. 35 people are putting their name in for those 10 slots. And so you'll work really hard and you'll prepare a story, and then you don't get to tell it. In fact, the story I'm going to share today was something I started for one of the slams. and I didn't get picked. And so I never got to tell the story. And so I worked on it and developed it for your show today. Later, I found that there were two things about the slams that were very difficult for me. And one of them was the 5 to 7 minute time limit. I find I'm much more comfortable with about 12 to 15 minutes for a story.
Yeah.
And the other thing is the competition. I don't like competing and being judged. Even when I win, I feel kind of badly about it. Something about it doesn't sit well with me. And I suppose it's because everybody's story is what it is, and it's hard to compare them. And so when you see somebody tell a really moving, tragic story and someone tell a funny story, how do you weigh those against each other? And so I think the best thing to do is to go into a slam just really feeling like it's not about the winner. It's not about judging. It's, you know, about building community, and the judging is really just involving the audience a little more. So I need to constantly remind myself of this, that it's not a judgment of people or the stories that they're telling.
The thing about the moth that I found hard is that they just randomly pick three teams out of the audience, and they sometimes have bizarre judging, and they judge stuff that, I don't know why you made that one the winner, because it wasn't anywhere near as good as XYZ. And
exactly.
Also the people at the...
wondered about that too.
Yeah, and the people at the beginning obviously have a disadvantage, because you don't know who you're judging. You know, the first person particularly, you've got nothing to judge it against.
So, especially when the first person has never seen a moth before, like you. You must have...
Although from that...
It's a really difficult position.
It was. But from that, I then got to have another storytelling thing at the Mill Valley Library, the Naked Truth series, which I had no idea was such a massive deal.
It's enormous. They pack the library. It's just incredible. I think there's 400 people at those.
Yeah, and they're all drunk.
They're getting free wine at those events too.
The free wine and they're all drunk. So it's the best audience. I mean, I loved it.
They're really very responsive. Yes, they are.
So it was fun. So, I mean, I got lots of things out of that. So it was fun to do that. And I got to meet people. But yeah, I just found the judging. I've always found the judging to be very odd. At the Moth. And so, like, you know, like we've both done West Side Stories with Dave Picorni, and he does it at the end. Everyone just texts in which person they like.
Yeah, I think that's a good move.
Slightly fairer, I think.
Includes a lot. Yeah, it's more fair. And then, of course, you know, if somebody brings a lot of friends to the event, then they, they will support their friend. But I think it is better than just one or two people that are picked randomly.
Yeah, because it's strange. There's always, I suppose there is a perfect way, but I do know what you mean about, it's just nice to hear a story without worrying too much about the competition side of it all. And that's why, you know, with Sunday Night Stories, we do have a story slam, but it's really just which one's your favourite. And it doesn't have to be that the others aren't any good. It's just one, you know, one gets a favourite and you move on. But that's the only sort of judging. We don't say who came second or third, and we just say who story was the
best. And many of your events are just celebrating the stories, is what I've noticed.
We do one
like a festival.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. We just have stories on there because we like stories and all different types of stories. And, you know, like I was saying, we had authors tell stories, and it's just fun to listen to a story without having to worry about judging it, and which is better. So I agree with you. It's just nice to have a story, isn't it?
I think some people really need that. It holds the whole evening together. It gives the evening itself a story, like, oh, they told a good story. And then this guy came at the end with this incredible story and won. You know, I think some people really enjoy that part of it.
Oh, but, yeah, they do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's really popular, isn't it, the Moth? I mean, everywhere.
It's extraordinary. And I got to meet George Dawes Green.
Oh, did you?
Who is the founder, I think he pronounces it Dawes, George Dawes Green.
I saw him at the festival in Fremont.
Yes, I saw him at that, and I went to his workshop. So it was really neat to chat with him and just see how incredulous he is as to what a phenomenon his idea has become, you know, across the country and around the world. And it's really amazing. And I thought it was interesting, you know, some of the things that he said about storytelling. He said, at the heart of a story, there is a choice. And he gave this example of somebody telling a story that I thought was really interesting. They were driving, they lost control of their car, and they were skidding around the freeway, and there was a Dodge Plymouth over here, the kind with bald tires, and it had a suitcase rack, and all these details. And then he skidded past that, and there was a 18-wheel truck, and there were all these details about the truck. And George said it was a boring story, even though the person's life was at risk, and it would be an exciting scene in a movie, maybe. But then something interesting happened. The car went over the edge and into the water, and the person was inside the car under the water. And if they opened the door, all the water would come crashing in. But if they left it shut, they would be trapped down under. And then he said, now it's an interesting story because they have this choice, and it draws the audience in and invites them to think, what would I do in this situation? And I thought that was just such a great example for the craft of personal stories, is to try to reach that moment where there is a choice and invite the audience in and get them thinking about what they would do in that situation.
Oh, nice. That's a great example. Yeah.
And that was in his workshop, and I thought it was really neat. Mm. And so I've been looking at a lot of the moth stories, and the ones that do win really do have these moments where there is that kind of choice being made, where you really have your audience in the palm of your hand. And you want to build up to that moment. And then, you know, the end of the story has some reflection and why you did what you did. But it's that moment you're searching for in a moth story, according to George Dawes Green. I thought it was pretty insightful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Nice. Oh, good little tidbit there. Excellent. So let's go on then, because you've written, I mean, four books, is it? Or five books?
Yeah, four.
And some of them, I've read a couple of them, and they're on storytelling, which are specifically, they're all about your stories that you've done at the Moth and other places, but they're not just a storytelling book, it's to help using it as a teaching tool, isn't it?
I teach at the college writing program at UC Berkeley in the summer, and because I'm full-time as a high school teacher in Santa Rosa during the regular year. And so I actually use those two books, Live to Tell and Live to Tell Again. And I have a third book coming out, and it's on the craft of storytelling. And it also has activities and exercises for how to use storytelling in English language learner classrooms. Mm-hmm. So it's a good way to provide content so that students can learn English. But I'm finding that a lot of regular UC Berkeley students are taking the class, not just people who are there for the summer to learn English. I'm getting a lot more of the full-time year-round students who are taking a summer semester because they're interested in storytelling and the craft of storytelling. And so those books are treating, each one has a different issue. The first one is really about truth and storytelling, truth versus being factual, which is more of a news report. And the second one is about self-discovery through storytelling. And the third one that I'm working on is about cultural appropriation, which is something that is such an important issue, especially even now with the Black Lives Matter movement and things like that, being sensitive to other people's identities and violating that. So I've been interested in this kind of interface between traditional storytelling and personal storytelling. I do a lot of traditional storytelling in my classroom where I tell folk tales and myths. And I started to think, you know, do I have a right to tell this story? Do you need permission from the people who own this story to tell this story in a classroom? And it really got me thinking, and it led me to various discussions with people. One thing that really caught my attention was there is a center in Sebastopol, actually, and it is called Weaving Earth. And they use Native American storytelling in really a process of self-discovery for people. And of course, they're very sensitive to the fact that they're borrowing Native American traditions. And they came up with this idea of appreciation, appropriation, and misappropriation. And they have these descriptions for what constitutes each one. And of course, there isn't a very distinct boundary between them. The real one to avoid, of course, is misappropriation.
Yeah.
And that is really where you are not being sensitive to the culture from which you are borrowing the story. The best case scenario is that you've worked with someone and you have their permission to tell the story. But very often we can't get that. Who do you ask from an ancient society, you know?
Yes.
But I'm also interested in how these traditional stories can inspire personal stories. And there's something special about the personal stories that they inspire. And this is based on an interview by Simon Brooks, who's a British storyteller.
Oh, I love Simon Brooks. Yeah, I definitely want to get him on our show. He's great.
Yeah, I hope you do. He's wonderful, because I reached out to him and he was so kind and he answered all my emails. And he has a podcast and he directed me to an interview with Michael Parent, who is a storyteller originally from Canada. He lived in New York. And he told a lot of traditional stories, but they ended up talking about the difference between personal stories and traditional stories. And Michael Parent said something that was very intriguing. He said, a traditional story is different because the empathy of the audience is for the story itself, whereas in a personal story, the empathy is for the teller. And so the empathy is much more limited in that case. And that's part of why a traditional story is more universal. And what it is doing, according to Michael Parent in the interview, and Simon Brooks is building with him on this idea, is that these traditional stories are really helping people work out problems that are deep within themselves. And so when they imagine themselves in the story, it's resonating with everyday problems they're facing. So really what it's doing is it's inspiring a personal story within you, your own story, your own reaction to that folktale. And I don't think they quite said this, but what I took from it is that there's this moment of magic where Michael Parent had told a classroom a folktale, and there was this boy in the back. He didn't seem like he was paying attention, but at the end of the week he did a series, I guess, and they were invited to tell stories. It was that boy that stood up and told a wild fairy tale using some of the things that had been in Michael Parent's stories but reformulating them in his own way. And the teacher afterwards said, wow, he has just been through I think his father had just passed away. And so you could see the boy working through his grief, through his own reformulation of this folktale. And both of them, Simon Brooks and Michael Parent, just paused and said, you know, that's what we're after in storytelling, this moment of magic. And we don't often, as storytellers, this is Michael Parent talking again, we don't get to see that when you're in front of a big group telling a traditional story. And you just have to trust that that's happening. And so I was fascinated by that. And I wanted to bring that out in my own storytelling by dramatizing that and telling a traditional story and then responding to it with my own story and capture that moment of magic that the traditional story has on me as a storyteller, but really me as a listener, because the personal story came from listening to the traditional story.
And that sort of models then for presumably your students, how you were able to make that moment of magic so that maybe they can.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. And this is so that's what my third book in the series, the Live to Tell series, is about, is that interface. But you're absolutely right. I'm modeling that moment of being touched enough by a story, a traditional one, to make and respond to it with my own personal story.
Nice.
So and I think in really a cool? That will be called, it's in the Live to Tell series, yeah. So it's going to have Live to Tell in it. It will probably be Live to Tell the Tale.
Oh, nice.
something like that. Yeah. I'm not sure. The Wazy Goose editor usually has the final say on it. Right. That's a small educational textbook press that I've ended up falling in with, and they've been just wonderful, wonderful to work with.
So your books, you can just buy them on Amazon, can't you, Brandon?
Yes, Amazon. Or website? And Barnes & Nobles carries it, I believe. And Copperfields, they're so supportive up here of local.
Copperfields, yeah.
And so they've got a few of my books. Excellent. Too.
And anyway, people can just go to your website, brandonspars.com.
Yes.
Yeah, lovely.
And the new one is really exciting because it is a collaboration with my daughter,
yes,
who is
a graphic artist.
And so this is it. It's called Rangda, the Legendary Goddess of Bali. And all of my life, I have wanted to write a book about this deity in Bali. She's one of the first things that really captivated me when I was living in Bali. I went to this ritual. It was at midnight at a temple. And in the gas lanterns that were lit and were hissing with clouds of incense, right in the middle was this person in trance inhabiting this deity. And part of the costume that they wear has fingernails that are a foot long. And you can imagine the shadows being cast, you know, on the walls of the temple. And this deity, the mask for the deity has hair down below the actor's waist and real pig teeth, tusks protruding from it. It's really quite a frightening appearance.
Yeah.
And this is really the village guardian. This is their protector. She has so many different roles, and I just never stop learning about her. And I can already think of another chapter I want to write for the expanded edition to this book, because she's really capturing a lot of the attention of artists right now, especially female artists. Women are really reclaiming her.
As and why is that?
Well, I think they're recognizing that Rangda has been, first of all, marginalized by the monotheistic religions, Christianity and Islam in Indonesia. She's been labeled as a demon, and the Balinese supposedly worship evil and things like this. And of course, that's not the case. She's responsible for cleansing and purifying and very positive roles. But I think that women are recognizing the role that state power has played in creating this character and associating her as strictly something negative and evil. And men only are allowed to play the part. And just recently, an artist by the name of Chok Sawitri, who is a woman, she gave a very large public performance where she went into trance and played the part of Rangda. And so there was this wonderful reunion of a woman actor playing the divine feminine, which had been played by men for so many years in this kind of patriarchal society. And so I think Rangda in many ways was shaped or misshaped by men's interpretation of what she was. And to have a woman reclaiming that was very, very powerful. Yeah. So she's, you know, this point of contestation in Balinese society where there's a lot of negotiating going on right now and discourse, yeah, dialogue, and people are really fired up about her in ways they haven't been in the past. It's exciting to see that. And of course, I've been, you know, I don't want to say a fan of a goddess, but I've just been, you know, so fascinated by her for all 30 years of my life after I first saw her that night in the temple. And I'm very glad to have been able to write the book. The best part of the book is my daughter's drawings, because she she captures, you know, the feel at the temple when I first saw her, and other encounters and anecdotes I have about her. And so I encourage people to take a look at that, if only for the art that's in the book.
No, it's great. I mean, your daughter's fascinating as well. She's got her own website. I mean, she's very entrepreneurial, isn't she? And she does music and illustrations and clothing, and amazing.
It really is impressive. I am continually just in awe of what she takes on. She's been very active in the Black Lives Matter movement, raising money for organizations that support that movement. And she designed symbols and stickers and sold those, and has raised probably $25,000 for the movement or something.
That's amazing.
With the sale of her stickers. She's exploring her own Balinese heritage through her art by carefully looking at Balinese art. And then, I suppose, in a similar way to me telling my own personal story, she's responding with her own designs to her own heritage. Her mother is, of course, Balinese.
Yeah. Oh, that must be, you must be so proud.
I am. I'm very proud. She's a senior at Stanford. And what a way to spend a senior year, virtual, you know, online. No football games, nothing,
none of the stuff that, you know, and being amongst all your friends. I mean, it must be so awful for them, as well so many people, isn't it? I mean, it's a very bizarre year, isn't it?
It certainly is.
How have you been coping? Are you doing Zooming online?
Yeah, I teach all day, every day, online. I have to wear Zoom glasses because I find, you know, after 4 hours or so, I really get worn down.
No, I wear, these are like computer glasses.
Good, yeah, that's good to have. I think it makes a difference.
Yeah.
And those are nice. Mine are really like, I don't know where they are right now, but they're, you know, they look like laboratory safety goggles is what they look like. And
funny. Well, I found that my eyes were twitching. I'd get like a twitch and I'd be blinking a lot.
I was getting headaches.
But this was before the pandemic, I would define that. And so because I spent all my time at work, you know, looking at the computer. So I got some just normal ones. And then when I was on all the Zooms with the Sunday Night Stories, I got very vain about wearing glasses.
Does Zoom exhaust you more than just looking at a Word document or something like that? I find Zoom...
I think it does. Although I just like to talk to people, whereas it's very boring looking at a Word document, but I like to actually interact with people. So for me, the positive outweighs the negative, I suppose. Yeah.
I find I can sit for 2.5 hours when I'm writing for one of the books, but I don't think I can Zoom for 2.5 hours.
No, you're quite right. No, I can't do that either.
It's rough.
I know. I've had Zoom chats with my friends, and after an hour, I must admit, that is enough. I've had enough after an hour. That is, I hadn't thought about that, actually. That's true, because I can definitely, you can concentrate, you know, I'm all day at my computer.
Yeah.
And maybe it is something about Zoom. And Zoomer, gosh, wish I had shares in Zoom, eh?
Yeah. It's interesting because people are adapting to it to tell their stories. You know, they're doing funny angles and things on their camera that they can't do with a live audience, I suppose.
No, and also you get to see all their facial expressions, which sometimes you don't. For me personally, it's interacting with people I would never have met. I couldn't, you know, they're all on the East Coast or in different countries. And I wouldn't have met them or known them. And you don't, and I can't afford to go to some of these or have the time off work to go to these festivals. And now I can do it online.
Yeah, you're right. There have been some real nice opportunities that have come out of the online practices of both, you know, teaching, but also in storytelling as well. And of course, I want to just say how active you've been in the world of storytelling with your 6 feet apart productions.
Yeah.
I think it's really amazing that you're building, you know, the moth of the online storytelling world.
We're sort of not quite, but I mean, we're definitely doing, what I like about it is I can do all different things. We do a story slam, and then we do traditional stories, and then I'm trying to do like comedy shows, and then we're going to do like, you know, mixing up, you know, the paired stories with a traditional and a personal on the same theme. And then we're going to have stories in living color when two different black person and a white person, or a person of color anyway, will then workshop a piece.
I'm really excited about that event. Yeah. I think it's wonderful.
Yeah. Because you're on the board, aren't you, the Storytelling Association?
I am, yeah. I'm writing a grant right now, which will hopefully help to compensate some of the storytellers for the time they put into it, because they're meeting, you know, they're building a relationship over an entire month before they actually tell the story. That time is has to be compensated for.
Yeah, so it's great. So, I mean, it's lovely to compensate storytellers. We've been trying to pay storytellers as well.
Yeah, I think it's really, really important, because for some of them, it's their livelihood. Mm. And I think even symbolically, it's important that a storyteller is compensated for their time, just because it shows there's value. And it's never enough. It shows that it is something that is to be valued in a society where, you know, only objects are valued these days. But storytelling is something that I think we have to continue to provide value in any way we can. And at least symbolically, the money helps with that.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. So you're going to tell us a story, aren't you,
Brian? I am. This fits into the pattern I was talking about. This is kind of a response to a Balinese belief that a person is never born alone, that your placenta and the water that breaks and some of the different things that come out with you when you're born are actually siblings. And it's called Kanda Empat in Balinese, which means your four siblings, and you're born with these. And they're with you all your life. And if you watch my wife eat her food, she always takes a pinch of rice and sets it on the table next to her. And that's for her siblings who follow her through her entire life. And it's believed that the universe has these siblings as well. And one is associated with the north, the south, the east, and the west. And I'm going to tell a story about the spirit that is associated with the east. Love. So here I go. So the summer that I got married to a Balinese woman in Bali, I was also doing research on trance for a graduate program in UC Berkeley. I gained audience with a trance master who used trance as part of his martial arts program, for which he was incredibly well known. To my delight, he agreed to do a demonstration with several of his students. "Yeah!" he shouted, and he cast spirits into his students. One of his students began to writhe around, hissing and foaming at the mouth. Another student just swayed very gently. "Cha!" he commanded the spirits to leave their bodies. And I was able to interview them before and after. I noted all their sensations. And then I stood up gratefully to take my leave. That was when he placed a heavy hand on my shoulder. Smiling, he took my recording device and handed it to one of his students. "Your turn," he said. I protested, but this was not a man who could be easily refused. Now, he had me sit down, face the east direction, and imagine the color white. I had to repeat over and over again, "Aku Pangil Angapati, Aku Pangil Angapati, Aku Pangil Angapati." When I returned to California, I was not the same person. Of course, I had been married, and my new role as a husband required an incredible amount of responsibility for my bride, who spoke very little English. However, at least from the Balinese perspective, I was not completely alone in my body. You see, I had begun to feel very uncomfortable during the trance process. And midway through, I had stood up and excused myself. Whereas he had cast a spirit into his students and then taken it out, I had left before he had taken the spirit out. So some might say I was walking around with a Balinese spirit trapped inside of me. A series of very strange episodes began. Most of them, strangely enough, on the freeways of the East Bay. I was driving, giving my wife a tour of the Bay Area, when I began to feel lightheaded and then faint. I unbuttoned the top button of my shirt. I rolled the window down and I began gasping for air. My wife looked at me uncertainly. I stammered and searched for the word. I feel funny, is what I said. She looked it up in her language learner's dictionary. Oh, funny, ha ha. But at this point, I felt like I was sliding down my own throat, leaving my eyes up above me with no one up there to drive the car. My wife realized the gravity of the situation when I had to pull over on the side of the road. And every time I tried to get back on the freeway, the same sensations would begin all over again. Eventually, with trucks and cars whizzing past me, I had to phone my brother. He came with a friend, and they drove both cars and us back to Berkeley. Instead of going home, my brother took me to the health center for graduate students, the Tang Center. I began in triage. Then they moved me to the cardiology unit, then doctor after doctor, until I ultimately ended up in the psychiatric department. "You're not feeling funny," the psychiatrist said. "You're feeling stress. It's from your new role as a husband. It's manifesting itself on your driving because you envisioned the head of the household as the driver of the car." He encouraged me to find an object, an anchor, that would keep me in reality. And he noticed I'd been playing with my jacket. So he told me I could set that over the steering wheel and fiddle with the zipper the next time it began. Well, it happened several other times, and it was the same thing every time. I would feel lightheaded and faint. I would roll the window down, gasp for air. I would unbutton my shirt. "Do you feel funny?" my wife would ask. "Yes," I would say. And then she began building on this like a dialogue in a language learner's textbook, adding words she found in her dictionary, like drunk and heart attack. And of course, it was the same thing at the Tang Center with the doctor. "You're not feeling a heart attack. You're experiencing a panic attack," he said. And he had taught me how to control my breathing, plant my feet, use a brown paper bag so that I would stop from feeling faint. One time, my brother was waiting for me in the waiting room of the Tang Center. I approached him, but he didn't stand up. He patted the chair next to him, and I sat down. He began to muse reflectively. "What's happened to you, man? What's happened to you? Ever since you've been married, you've changed. Now, the only thing you need to know about my brother, he's a lot bigger than me, and his neck is the size of my waist. The core of his personality, and he would be the first to admit this, is that he is an Oakland Raiders football fan. Ever since you've been married," he continued, "you've forgotten how to laugh. You're taking life too seriously." And now he was waxing eloquently, full of folksy wisdom. "I'm going to tell you a little something that maybe your doctors with their brown paper bags and zippers aren't going to tell you. The next time you have one of your little episodes, I want you to pop this baby in." And he handed me an old, dirty cassette tape. "You'll be feeling right as rain," he said. Well, the next time was on the Bay Bridge, and the stakes were higher because there was nowhere to pull over. I began to feel faint. I began to gasp for air. Of course, my new bride asked, "Do you feel funny?" "Yes," I said. "Do you feel drunk?" "Yes." "Do you feel heart attack?" "Yes," I said. At this point, my vision had tunneled to the point of a pinhole, and I distinctly recall picturing very clearly myself back at the compound of that trance master. I could hear every breath being taken by the many students that were watching. I could see myself. I could hear the floor as it creaked with every shift of weight on the part of the people watching. In the last shreds of consciousness that I had, I remembered the cassette tape. I jammed it in and I spun the volume dial up to maximum. I knew what the cassette was right away. It was from my childhood. I was probably 8. My brother was probably 6. There was another pair of siblings over. It was a dinner party. Our parents were upstairs after dinner, talking by candlelight, having drinks, and we were downstairs. We had made this cassette as a joke to slip under their table and stealthily make our escape. I knew it was this cassette from the very first raspberry being blown into the crook of someone's arm, from the very first dramatic gasp of relief. And now this cassette was blasting in my car. My wife searched frantically in her language learner's book for a word. It wasn't the cassette that did it. It was the expression on the face of a woman as she passed me. Traffic had been stacking up behind me because I was going about 10 miles an hour on the Bay Bridge. And she had driven, rolled her window down, presumably to yell some sort of obscenity at me. And there I was, breathing into a brown paper bag, my wife shouting, "Poo-poo, is this poo-poo?" with the symphony of flatulations booming from my car out over the San Francisco Bay. She mouthed the words, "Oh my God." And I laughed. I laughed. And then I don't remember a single thing after that. Apparently, according to my wife, I straightened up, accelerated to a respectable 55 miles an hour, got off at Treasure Island, turned the car around, and headed back to Berkeley. This would have all been fine, and my wife was pleased that I had regained control of the vehicle, except for the fact that while I was doing this, I was laughing, a laugh she had never heard me do before or since. To this day, my wife is convinced that it was someone else or something else sitting next to her driving the car that day. Total dissociation, total dissociation, a total break with reality is what the psychiatrist said. He put me on a prescription for the hot new medication. I believe it was called clonazepam. And he assured me these episodes would stop. For good measure, I didn't drive on the freeway for a year. Now, during the end of that year, I went back to Bali to visit my in-laws with my bride. And I eventually made my way back to that trance master. He wasn't at all surprised that I had come back. And he removed what he said was a spirit that had been trapped inside of me for the better part of a year. His explanation as to why I was having these episodes on the freeway was quite fascinating. Of course, he was just as sure that these episodes episodes would come to an end as the psychiatrist was. It wasn't so much the fact that I was driving a car as the direction I was driving the car. Angapati, the spirit that was inside of me, was the spirit of the East. And to be heading west was a violation of Angapati's sensibility. Indeed, every time I had had an episode, I had been heading west. It's interesting how the same phenomenon viewed from different perspectives can be interpreted so differently. The Western perspective sees this as a disorder in need of being suppressed, lest it cause antisocial behavior. And of course, the Eastern perspective, represented by the Balinese, see this as something that is desirable and deliberately sought after. Now, as a high school teacher, every year I see that more and more of my students are suffering from panic disorders and anxiety. And of course, for this, disruptive and expensive medications are prescribed. It leads one to wonder whether this tiny island in the corner of the Indian Ocean, with their acceptance of this as something natural and their dedication of a social space to this, might not have something that they can teach us. It's been 25 years since I felt funny on the side of the road. And of course, since then, my wife, she's built the entire English language around the words funny, drunk, and heart attack. She's fluent now. I never experienced anything like these episodes on the freeway since, except starting about 8 years ago when I began to perform stories at larger venues. I did experience stage fright, and I might have even stopped performing if I hadn't learned to embrace it. So now, every time I take the stage, that's what you get. A guy who's maybe behaving a little funny, almost like he's either drunk or sometimes on the verge of a heart attack. Or maybe what you're getting is someone who's been possessed by a spirit. Only in this case, I'd like to think it's the spirit of storytelling. Thank you.
Excellent. What a fabulous story. Thank you, Brandon. I was transfixed the whole time. God, and how, I mean, I'm so pleased you got the spirit removed.
Yeah, me too.
Driving. It's difficult to drive, not driving on the freeways around here, isn't it?
Especially when you live in Berkeley.
Yes. Wow. God, that must have been scary.
It was. Yeah, I've never told this. I told you I prepared it for a competition. The theme was a method to my madness. And so that's what I'm going to title this story. But I did tell it to my students, you know, various versions of it over the years when we study trance in ritual. And this story really does touch them, especially the students who experience panic attacks.
There are a lot of people, young people who do that. And it's so sad, isn't it?
Yes.
So how interesting that you have this different perspective.
Yeah, I really think there is something about trance and what we see as these anxiety disorders. In fact, there's a doctor, she's a psychologist in Bali, she's Balinese, and her name is Suryani. And she is doing a lot of work on the commonalities between these panic disorders and trance. And so I'm not sure what her latest is, but I know she's made this connection before in the past. But I think Bali as a society, you know, doesn't suppress this. In fact, they give a channel for this kind of energy to be released. And like I said, it's something that is potentially very positive and can be very nurturing and cleansing to have experiences like this. And it's something that is also natural. I think that's important, that we can naturally slip into this state And in the West, we're taught to resist that and to fight it and squelch it out. Whereas in Indonesia, in Bali, I don't say the rest of Indonesia because Islam has ended a lot of the older practices that use this. I think that people are allowed to experience this as something that is cleansing and rejuvenating rather than taxing and debilitating.
Right. Well, how interesting. I will have to go and have a look. I'll look that person up and find out a bit more about it.
Yeah, Suryani, Suryani. And she's kind of leading the field in this crossover, I believe.
How interesting. And because both my kids, for some reason, you know, have panic attacks every so often. And
yeah,
we all. I just find it strange, you know. So it's just, it's horrible to be put on medication or anything. So.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh.
And that seems to be the Western way, isn't it? And to have a pill for it.
Exactly. And stop it.
Yeah, yeah.
Cut it out. Get rid of it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Brandon, thank you. That was fascinating, all of it. I love talking to you. And best of luck with your book, Ranga, and also your new book that's coming out. And again, if anybody is interested in Brandon and his stories, it's brandonspars.com. Go out and find him because he's got lots of videos on his website. He's so funny. He does the best stories. Told a brilliant story about, lovely story about meeting his wife on 6 feet apart. So go and look at that. And Brandon, really good luck with your book sales and send my love to your family and hope you get to work with Clara a bit more.
Thank you. Me too. She shares your name with...
Oh, I know. Lovely name.
That's a beautiful name. We love that name.
Yes. There you go. And thank you everyone for listening and see you next time. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.